How do you motivate employees overall? Which is always like the big thing. You don't, you inspire them. You have to inspire people to work for you. How do you inspire people? You have to give them a vision. You have to figure out what the purpose is. What is our life purpose, period?
As an employer, your business depends on your staff. They are the backbone of your company. But because you face unique challenges managing your team, you need to have the right resources. On this podcast, industry expert Alex Atwood tackles it all so you don't have to.
I am so excited today to be talking to entrepreneur and culinary training expert Maria Copasadas. Maria comes from a family of cooks and cookbook authors, health experts, and professional chefs. And she spent years developing her training school, Cookology, which has now expanded into not just a recreational training school for people looking to have fun classes around cooking and all of that, but now she's actually built a community around learning the culinary arts, both professionally and recreationally. She's opened a professional training school, and now she's Cookology is a high quality, affordable cooking school that teaches all ages how to cook. And she's gone from having a recreational training school to a professional training school. It's awesome to see you. I am so happy to have you here. It's been a while since I've wanted you on the show. And so here you are. So let's get started. So I know that, first of all, you're local to DMV. You grew up in a Greek household. I know those two things. And I learned
Greek and Italian.
Okay, that's super important. Both of those ethnicities, they synthesize well.
Una faccia, una rasa.
So let's get started. So you grew up in obviously an ethnic household, but you grew up around a lot of cooking, right?
Yes.
But you became a bartender but you were also cooking. So I want to hear about, I know.
I told you that story. That's really embarrassing.
I know everything.
Yeah.
But tell me about your background. Tell me about what it was like growing up in a Greek/Italian home and where you started to fall in love with the culinary world.
Sure. It was no picnic. But there was always really good food and everybody talked about food everywhere we went. And you were sort of judged on how well the meal was, which I've always sort of taken into everything. And I always say with weddings, people remember the food and the photos. And so don't spend all your money on the venue. No one's going to remember. Everyone's going to remember the food and the photos. And it's true. But my grandmother was Greek American, married a Greek national, and just wanted to cook for him and just fell in love with learning how to cook for him and everything. And they met at church on 16th Street in DC. And she used her cooking to raise money for her favorite charities. And she became kind of this charity maven. Marion Capsidis is her name. You can Google her. She had her 3-page obituary in the Washington Post. I mean, she was just so well known and just this really incredible woman who lived to 92 and just had a million friends. And she was just, she was awesome. Yeah. But cooking, going to dinners and around the holidays, like the grandmothers would split up and one would go into her corner and, you know, of the kitchen, the other in her corner of the kitchen, and they would compete over gravy.
Are you serious?
Gravy was a big deal. And it was like the giblet gravy versus like the smooth gravy. And it was a gigantic deal for the grandkids to acknowledge that, yes, we like them both. So, I mean, you were forced to try things. Huh?
Yeah. You guys were like the judges in a family like cooking contest show.
It was really horrible. You know, it was just too much pressure.
How many grandkids were there?
There were four. I mean, I was the only girl on the Greek side. Mm-hmm. It was a nightmare. And there was four kids on the other side, not the only girl, which is totally fine. So, yeah.
How do you like that? So there you were, right? Getting this unique opportunity to taste and be a part of these two cultures, not just the culinary pieces of it, but two cultures that are expressed through food, right? That were in your kitchen, in your home. Right. That's something not a lot of people get. I mean,
the two classic immigrant sides of the 60s, 70s and 80s. Right.
Yeah.
And my grandmother was very much the type of woman that was like, Maria, you need to learn how to cook, because the first thought that you should have in the morning is, what is your husband going to eat when you I was like, what is your husband going to eat for dinner? That should be your very first thought.
Like, that's funny.
Well, that's not going to happen. I'm a massive feminist, and that started really, really early. And anything like that said to me, I was like, yeah, whatever. And that just frustrated my yaya, like you cannot imagine. She was super, but she was also super independent. Yeah. And she saw a lot of me in her, and I had the opportunities that she didn't have. And she took those opportunities. She just took it. Like, this is her. I have this picture. This is my grandmother. This is the Washington Post.
Oh, wow. Look at that.
2000. There she is. This is her baklava and her curumbiadas. And this is the recipe for the curumbiadas in the Washington Post. Isn't that crazy?
Wow, that is crazy. So you come from a lineage of this here, Maria.
Yeah.
Wow.
She's incredible.
Wow, that is incredible. What a matriarch for all of this.
The matriarch, right?
Oh, I love it. I love it. See, I didn't know any of this stuff about you. So this is so interesting. So tell me, like, what was your first inspiration in terms of creating something, like an entrepreneur, right? So being a creator, when did you see that as being something that you wanted to take on?
I had so many ideas. I had so many ideas, and my parents discouraged every single one of them. I mean, even to cookology, they were like, stay in your job. And I was like, no. And I mean, I wanted to do in the early 90s before College Park had this space, and I was a big thrift shop person. Like I still am. And a friend of mine was going to Russia and he was selling jeans. And he was like, pick me up as many jeans as you can. And I would like go in and we'd find like all these beautiful, like perfectly pristine pairs of jeans. This is the 90s. Like they just didn't kind of have the same relationships with China that they do. I get everything for nothing. So he would just take it over and then he'd bring me back this pile of cash. And I'm like, oh my God, let's open a store. And we knew like everyone started to get like really like the 60s and 70s started to come back and people were like, Grooves in the Heart came out, that song. And then everyone was looking for like crazy, cool 60s stuff to wear.
I remember.
Curating all of that. And I had this boyfriend who was an artist. And so he was working for the Fifth Column doing like all their art. And so it was just this really, really cool creative stuff. So that was like kind of the first thing. And I wanted to open a store. And my mom was like, no, blah, 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 blah. And I should have, because literally a year later, somebody opened the store in the exact same space I wanted to do it. And it wasn't Remix. It was called something else. It was in College Park and it was there forever. And it was incredible. And so I really thought, I have these ideas and people end up doing them. What's next? Right. And so and then I got into sales. I wanted to get out of the city for a little while because it was getting on my nerves. And I rented a townhouse in Virginia Beach and like three blocks from the beach. And some friends of mine came down with me and I ended up getting a sales job. I went down to bartend and I was like, I just can't do this anymore. Like, I just am not a bartender. It takes a certain wanting to hear everyone's stories and people kind of treating you like crap. And like, you have to have, and I was like, I just can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And I answered a job ad and it was like sales, learn the sales pitch, and then eventually get to work in St. Croix. And I was like, oh, that's me. And I went down there and I wore my like nicest outfit that I brought with me to the beach. And I interviewed, they trained me and I was like top salesperson. And I was like, wow. Not even 21, right? Like I'm so young. And I remember because I couldn't drink at the bar that I won this gift certificate because I had gotten top sales and all this other stuff. And that from there just made me, just instilled so much confidence in my ability to do stuff outside the box.
Yeah.
And then it was one idea after the other. I ended up having my own writing services company that turned into like websites and all kinds of other stuff. So, I mean, I've done a lot and helped other entrepreneurs along the way. So,
wow. Yeah, it's very interesting. Well, that's a perfect bridge. So you had a B2B. How many employees did you have in that writing company?
I had two, just me and one other person.
You and one other. Got
it. Yeah, that's it. No, I mean, we knocked it out. And then I ended up jumping in. People would hire me and they'd be like, hey, can you come in and do X, Y, and Z? I'm like, sure. And then I'd stay there for a while. And, you know, things started, I was like, well, now I really want a real job because I've got all of these skills. Let me see how much money I can go get. And so putting down, you know, like all my clients on my resume, it's just like, who is going to know? But I mean, these people stuck with me for years and years.
Yeah. So you went out there to get a quote unquote real job after you had already been the freelance sort of, you know, had your own business, doing business to business. You went back out there to get back in the corporate world.
I mean, I hit 33. Mm-hmm. And I worked at Discovery Channel as publicist for 3 years for India and Australia. And that was my first real job in corporate America. And I didn't like it. And so I went back and started working with my friend Tim, who had this, he was like reselling phone services in apartment buildings. Like they used to do that. Like, you know, Bell, all the Bells were competing and they don't do that anymore. And then, and so we started that business and then he got picked up by Ericsson and just has had this crazy career. I think he's working for Apple now. Like he's just out there doing all this crazy stuff. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to put my resume together and see what I get. And I started working for, God, who did I work for after that? I started kind of going into food. Now I was like really sort of interested in the food industry and the background of the food industry. Like I was trying to pursue things that I liked. Like I liked food. I liked sales. I liked communications. So what was going to really like fire me up and make me want to get up every day and go there? And that was, it's called Consumer Product Goods Association. It used to be called Grocery Manufacturers of America. And I was their webmaster, essentially, which is crazy. Really? And their communications department. And so I was basically responsible for all their content. And it was a crazy job. And then I got pregnant. I had my daughter. I got pregnant. I was pregnant there. I had my daughter. And then I got headhunted by this other company called Access Technologies, IT company. And they were just like, we're going to give you a laptop, an Apple. I mean, this is 2006. We're going to give you a Mac. And I was like, oh my God, 17-inch Mac. And I was like, what? And then we're going to, you're going to get your own office and you get da-da-da-da-da. And I was like, dude, you had me at hello.
You had me at laptop. Sign
me
up.
You had me at Apple laptop. And he was like, okay, cool. And my daughter was 4 months old. And I was just like, I have to do this job.
Stability. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I was not a single mom. I was married to her dad and he just happened to be just not as ambitious and on track with me. He was 7 years younger and all this other stuff. So I was sort of the breadwinner and we were doing fine, but it was just kind of like, and I also like to work. I mean, let's be honest. So yeah.
So there you went. Okay. So there you are, right? You are now on the precipice of starting into the food industry. Like you're actually like now working in the food industry. So tell me how soon after you were the webmaster for the Food Industry Association, did you decide to start Cookology? Or was there something in between that?
Yeah. So Access Technologies was next. And
oh, that's right. Access. Yep.
And then my boss, Eric Ainsley, who I still love and who invested in Cookology in the very early years, my daughter was getting sick. And like, you know, the household, you know this, like one gets sick and then everyone gets sick.
Yeah.
And we were out. I was out for a while, but I was working from home. But that's before working from home was really allowed. But I had my 17-inch laptop, Eric. Hello. I'm going to be fine. Yeah. I've got an internet connection. And so, but he said to me, you know, you're a little too sick all the time and you're not working enough here. And I was like, that's it. Like Cookology is on. So 2003, I wrote the business plan. That same week, I wrote the business plan and hired a person to help me with the financials, which I didn't quite really understand in terms of restaurants and how that was run. So I hired a professional and she was helping me out with that. And I purchased my condo in DC and I was like, yeah, I got my condo. I was like living in it. So like, I got to buy it. I was so excited. And then I found out I was pregnant and I was like all in the same week. And so I was like, okay, I can't do this when I'm pregnant. Yeah. Like I can't, I was, you know, just impossible. I can't do open Cookology. So I just literally sat on it for 6 years. And during that time, I would work on it all the time. And like, it gave me energy. It gave me life. And I'd be like, anything was going wrong, I'd be like, I'm going to go just work on Cookology. And I called it Any Day Gourmet because there's a cute little shop in Tacoma Park and I didn't know what to call it. So I just opted that name. And then when he said that to me, I called my husband and said, it's back on. And Cookology, I started to figure out a way to get out of Access. And so Access had a lot of success. They sold the company to Heron Consulting. It was all very successful. And so then I moved on to McKinley Marketing Partners and became a consultant. And I was working in this really great job. And they kept me there for 2 years while I made ridiculous amounts of money as a consultant. And because I wasn't bringing it home and feeling like, oh, I've got to work 14 hours. You know, my job depends on it. I was a consultant. I was like, okay, good night, everybody. It's 5. Like, oh my God, I have so much time. And I'd go home and hang out with my baby. And then I'd put her to bed and I'd work on my, it just like, I had so, like, I was meant to do this. Like, it just, the paths opened up, all the doors started opening. Mm. And then I had to go find an SBA loan, which was a nightmare. And there was a small community bank in DuPont Circle, and I would take them warm Krispy Kreme donuts. I'd wait till that light comes on in DuPont Circle, and I'd go get a dozen, and I'd go up to the building, and I'd drop it off and be like, are you guys working on my loan? Crazy lady's back with the donuts. And people would be like, get out of my way. And so I got a reputation for like being a little persistent with donuts. And they finally approved my SBA loan, but I had to pick the space. At that time, they would not let me just pick a space that I wanted. Before I got my money, SBA needed to approve where I was going to put the space. Mm-hmm. So like DC was out. It was like completely out. Like I couldn't have it in DC, and Maryland was too expensive. Bethesda and Silver Spring, like just insanely expensive, still is. And someone called me and said, hey, do you want to look at the space in Dulles Town Center? And drove me around Loudoun County in 2007 and said, this is what the county is doing. And they want to have the same GDP as Baltimore by 2022, which they kind of do. And, you know, they want to do all these things. And I was like, okay, I'm sold. Oh, it's the wealthiest county in the country. And da, 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 da. And the learners gave me an incredibly huge chance on this ridiculous idea. And Cookology Dulles Town Center was born. And then the economy crashed.
So there you go. The roller coaster continues.
I mean, I was 80% built out, and my,
This would have been what, 2000, what year was this?
2008, 2009.
2008, yep. That's when the economy crashed. Yeah.
And then from that point on, Cookology has never been easy. I went from everything I do turns to gold to like, oh my God, what am I doing? Like, I can't get any of this right. And I know I'm supposed to be here, but I clearly keep like screwing this up and almost closed. And I mean, I've done some crazy things to stay, to keep that business going. And it's obviously a labor of love, because I should have gotten out of it like 10 years ago. but here I am.
Yes. Well, there you were in what you describe as a very comfortable like situation. You have tons of time, you're getting paid an ungodly amount of money, and yet you have this passion to create something. You want to manifest this thing, and it's beyond the money at that point. I mean, all of us as entrepreneurs, we look at it as, oh, you know, this is going to be something huge and it's going to pay off financially for us. Really, it's not. And from what I'm hearing, it wasn't the financial payoff that had you continue down this road. It's some sort of love, some sort of passion, something.
It's like a foot on your back. That's the only thing that I could really kind of spiritually assign words to. I was like, I feel like I'm being physically, there's a hand or something just is like, keep going, just keep going. And, you know, I mean, like, I grew up in a Greek Orthodox household. Like, God has been, you know, served on a platter for my entire life. And so, like, you go to church, you've got your mati, you know, you got to light the candle. There's a lot of voodoo in your religion. It's weird. Everything's so. And then you've got your yaya. But, like, spirituality doesn't happen until you hit rock bottom. And that point, you're like, hey, wait. What's the deal? Do I have to read more of this book? Like, am I not doing that right? Like, do I have to go to church now? Do I light more candles? Like, then you start to really dig into like who you are and what your place is in the universe, because it's all out there and you have your home attached to your SBA loan as collateral. And you're like, I'm going to just lose everything.
Yeah.
You just started. The economy has collapsed. No one's coming to help you. And everyone else that you know at that time had lost money in the market because the markets are crashing too. People have no value in their homes, people that you know. Your parents and everybody are like, no, 10-foot pole. And you're just like, oh my God, this is actually happening. And it was crazy. I got a couple loans from some people, small loans. The Obama administration gave out like 50 grand. I was able to pay some bills. So 2009, I opened February 14th, Valentine's Day. Can you imagine? Valentine's Day. I was like, oh my God, it's the day of love. And people were like lining up around the block to buy gift certificates. And I was like, oh man, we are on like Donkey Kong. Okay. So as the year is going by, it's getting worse and worse and worse. There's like tumbleweeds going down the mall. Like no one is coming out. And I do this pitch video with my husband, and we win. Richard Branson put out a pitch thing, and I'm like top 10, right? This video is just so awesome. And then they fly me to LA, and I'm trying to get people to look at it for franchising, and all the franchisers that are there are like, we don't want to touch this with a 10-foot pole. And I was like, okay. So a little bit more going on with that. And then finally I was like, I'm resigned to maybe just close this by the end of the year. December 8th, 2009, I'm like, I have $8,000 in the bank, $10,000 the next day. Da, 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 da. And I'm like, what is happening? And people were buying gift cards. We had enough money as like a slush fund. I was able to like pay all my debts and still had money to like, let's keep promoting and getting into January. And the January was so hot. February was like, people were like, hey, they're still here and we're going out. We want to do something fun. I mean, this kind of thing, this pandemic, it's not like the recession. It's like something that if Cookology survives the pandemic, I will know that I can pretty much do anything.
Yes. We're not even there yet. We're talking about 2009, where you decided.
2009.
Yeah, where you said in 2009, this might not go past this year. That was 12 years ago. And that was prior to a pandemic, right? Which completely decimated the industry.
So many people. Yeah.
So here, let me just backpedal just a little bit, because this is very interesting. So you opened a business that there wasn't, like, from what my understanding, I could be completely wrong, but I don't think you could model what you did with Cookology around like another like thriving recreational cooking school that was just out there. Maybe it was out there, but I wasn't aware of it really until I met you.
And well, it's funny because Culinary in DuPont Circle opened at the same time, but they were coming from the L'Académie de Cuisine world, where they were teachers with L'Académie de Cuisine in Bethesda, and they taught in the very French way. And I had taken a couple of classes there, and I was just like, I hate these classes, because you're like getting a demo. So you're listening to someone, and then you partner off, and then you cook with someone. I was like, why can't I have my own ingredients? And, you know, I mean, I took that class in years before I opened a cooking school, but it just kind of stuck with me. Like, if I was going to do a food service business, I totally open a cooking school, and I would make sure that everybody was. And I was looking in a magazine, and they had students in Morocco that were learning something all around this huge table. And I was like, that's it. That's exactly what it should be. And I was like, And then it just kept growing and growing. And the kids thing grew because I had a kid. And so Kiki was 5 when I opened. She was 4.5 when I opened.
Wow.
So I was able to be like, okay, how would I have a birthday party for a 4-year-old? And so I've been able to have like every year, like understanding the development of a child going, I mean, and she was able to come with me to work, which was amazing. And I got to go to all of her field trips, and I had literally, Cookology has never made me any money, but it has made me an amazing life. And my daughter is 17. She's going to college next year. And I've got to spend all this time with her. I mean, she hates it now. It's like, God, go to work. Ugh, why are you here?
Well,
like,
look, you built a community around Cookology. That's the one thing that's palatable when you go to visit you at Cookology. There's a community that is sort of a hub for them. So while 100%, you picked a very unique business to get into, like it's the food industry, but you're concerned about putting people into chairs or actually having people pay for training, which in itself is not the easiest thing to do. And you've managed to do that starting in a recession and through a pandemic. And with that, you're also very grateful to be able to have built this and to be able to have your daughter, who you've spent a lot of time with, and you've actually shaped what is now a family activity based on what you discovered early on. So while, like, I totally get that the financial isn't there yet, but I'd like for people watching this and hearing this that there's a lot more out there that really is fulfilling and nourishing that does not always include a big payoff. And right prior to this conversation, I had another podcast earlier with someone who had sold his marketing company to Oracle for a huge amount of money, and he felt 100% empty when that happened. Like, he felt like he did not know what to do next. Yeah. So listening to you and how much this has sort of nourished you through the process is awesome. So let's talk about the pandemic. So you went through the recession, and I happen to know because we started to get more familiar with each other between the recession and the pandemic. And
I know 2019. I opened the second location. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And so there you were, you know, you had the grandest ideas about, you know, putting a professional culinary school together and also keeping. Yeah, you did. Absolutely. And you
continue. It's now a nonprofit. And I now have the nonprofit version of it.
And I want to talk all about that. As a matter of fact, I want to dig into that here in like 2 minutes. But what I want to hear about a little bit first is like, how did you keep your team like connected, you know, during the pandemic? Like, what did that, how did you do that? Because, you know, to be in an industry that completely almost goes away and to be in a B2C business, which is a business to consumer deal where people can't even get around each other. You had a double whammy, right? Aimed at you. So how did you keep the team together? How did you keep the culture together?
Right. So it's been years in the making, right? Like Mark has been with me since the very beginning. And,
and who's Mark?
Manager, Mark Chang, yeah. Chef Mark Chang. It. And there have just been, Corey's been with me since 2015. She's now in a, you know, she's doing events because we had to kind of move her position off of what she was doing before. And I mean, there, so, and I'm writing a book on this because I really feel like there's a couple things going on. One, how do you motivate employees overall? Which is always like the big thing. You don't, you inspire them, right? You have to inspire people to work for you. How do you inspire people? Especially when they're not necessarily making $90,000 to $150,000 a year. We're talking about people that are not making that money. I couldn't charge the amount of money per person to be able to pay my chefs that. It's not an industry standard either. So it's food service. Typically, your profits are about 4 to 5% for most restaurants. Now, we do a little bit better because the way that I control expenses and over the years have learned how to do this. So I'm running it completely differently than a restaurant. But you have to give them a vision. Like, it's not just about being a nice person. I've had really nice bosses and I've had really shitty bosses that have been really inspiring. And, you know, you have to figure out what the purpose is. What is our life purpose, period, right? And from there, it's like, I don't know if you've read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. Mm-hmm. It's a great book. It's literally about finding that purpose, and people who have had purpose in life were able to stay alive during while they were in a concentration camp. Now, my life doesn't feel like a concentration camp, although sometimes during the pandemic it feels a little weird. But I think going out and kind of saying, hey, guys, we are here in business to help these kids. And you can see we do a lot of children. We do a lot of adults. But I think the thing that gives us the most joy is watching these kids come in over and over and over again to learn from every single chef in the store and take all the classes and stuff like that. Or seeing and hearing someone that is just like, I cannot believe I made this, which we hear all the time. And it does something to you. It allows you to feel like you're being a part of someone's life. So if you think about all of the people that we've taught as tiny pebbles falling into a lake, and then all of the ripples that have gone out with all of the people that we've influenced in some way to cook at home for themselves, for their families. I mean, and it's not just learning how to cook, it's learning how to eat. And it's expanding your palate and doing all those wonderful things so that you can go out to a restaurant and some little things you get off of the fast food thing. You're more like, well, I can actually make this in a shorter period of time. You're helping people in just so many different ways. Mm-hmm. And when I get on my soapbox and start preaching to people that first come to work for me, they're like, oh, like you can kind of see the realization. There's more of a purpose here for me than just going and working in a restaurant or working behind the line.
Yeah.
Well, which I'm not saying there isn't there, but like, you know, it can, and just cookology can get kind of boring as well. But I think most people who stay on, they have just such a passion and they have a passionate need to help people in some way.
Yeah. Well, it makes absolutely 100% sense. And it's clear that you've injected this life, the sustainability into your business that is so far beyond the financial, so far beyond sort of the capitalistic way of growing a business. It's a lot more than that. It's community, it's culture, it's impact, right? Yes. And it's impact. And I love the analogy you make about the ripples. And if you think about each person that's come through the program as a particle into a pond or a stream or a body of water, and how those ripples eventually start to really make impact across the entire ocean, just from that.
One person in your family of 12, you're cooking, you're teaching the kids, you're sitting down now, you're having dinner, you're creating space, you're taking time, you're feeling good, you're changing your life. It's not just, oh, I went and bought a $30 cookbook. It's like, I'm coming in and learning how to do this And I feel good about myself because I'm sitting down and I'm eating it. And this, okay, maybe I would change that. You're starting to think a little bit farther down the line about what you're going to do next and how you're going to cook at home. And it's massive. It's massive. And I think it was a definite need, that arm on my back felt like maybe nobody else was going to do this, but I was the crazy enough person that they chose for me to do this because they knew I would go all the way. Sometimes I think like that, like, why me? Like, this is so hard. Like, why?
And there's the matriarch, your grandmother up there saying, you're just taking, she's doing this. And she's saying, there she is. And you're just carrying on her legacy into a new millennium. Really? I mean, you're carrying that on.
Seriously. I mean, the parties my grandmother, my mom used to give, I would sit there and be like, how can we monetize this? I didn't know the word monetize. I'd say, how can we make money off of this? And then Martha Stewart came along and I went, I have been telling you ladies that we could have made money off of this. And she just figured it out. And they were like, oh my God.
That's right. That's right. That's awesome. That's awesome. And so that, first of all, that's so inspiring. And what I really, really love about really the transition that you made from comfort, financial stability, time to chasing your passion and building a community and a culture that is outside of monetary and inside of impact. So that's like truly inspiring. What does the future hold for Maria? What does the future hold for Cookology? This is a great opportunity for you to talk about the nonprofit. Anything else you'd love to put in?
So we had, remember Cookology 21, I changed the name. And it's Metropolitan Culinary Arts Institute now. Because people kept confusing the brands. And I was like, this is just getting a little crazy. And so so then during the pandemic, we started in 2020 with our first class. And we were able to graduate the kids out during the pandemic, which was wild. And but I didn't pick up anyone else because, you know, we didn't have the vaccines. And I was just really nervous Nelly about the whole thing. And then we got the vaccines back. And then I started to really work on working with other people to get into the workforce, like creating a workforce program that made sense for people, not only just the people that were learning a job skill, but also the restaurants that desperately needed people. And so you and I have talked about this forever. So, and so one of the things that really changing into a nonprofit, this particular arm. So it's a 6-week program. People can come in and every Monday they can learn a skill, and it's a 5-6 hour class. And you're learning one knife skill and a bunch of, you're going through the National Restaurant Association's textbook, and you're basically learning to become a prep cook. Okay. So you start off as a prep cook at any restaurant. We're going to place you into a position in a restaurant where you want to be. So cafe to Michelin starred restaurant, wherever you want to be, we're going to put you there as a prep cook. We're going to make sure that you're going to be taken care of. And we're going to advocate for you to make sure that you like it there, right? You and I talked about advocacy and like how to make sure the people are, once they get into these jobs, they're feeling good about it. And the restaurant who takes on that person will be paying for their education and being able to write it off as a charity donation, ultimately. So it's a donation-based organization that helps train chefs. And so I've had a lot of people, a lot of different restaurants who have asked me for people. And I'm like, bring me your favorite dishwasher. Bring me the person that shows up on time. We'll train them to be a prep cook. And you're going to get really fast on all the knife skills. Like, you're going to be able to move through the prep pretty quickly. And that's our goal. Because anybody can learn how to chop, dice, brunoise. Anybody can learn how to do that. It's just the speed. And then you're doing soup stock sauces and you're learning cooking methods. And then you're getting some of the really important skills on inventory and how to count inventory and the math. Like, I always take it 10 steps farther. I'm always like, okay, you know, this is what we're going to do. We're going to go downstairs and I'm going to teach you business. You know, like, do you think that company's making money? How many pierogies do they have to sell in order to make $1 million? Do you want to do pierogies? That kind of thing. So,
yeah. So you have these. So basically, you can take folks who have that baseline sort of passion in what it is and have the, at least they are able to show up on time. They're able to have those sort of fundamental pillars to be able to success or have success around anything, right? Believing in themselves to a certain degree and having some sort of structure set up to where they can show up to a work or show up to a class or all of that they come in with, and you teach them from there. So you can teach them all the technical skills needed. You can put them into a restaurant, or you can put them into an environment where they're set up for success. That is awesome. And if anybody wants to learn more about Cookology or about the Metropolitan, was it the Metropolitan
Culinary Arts Institute? It's metroculinaryarts.com or cookologyonline.com.
And you guys can click on the links below to get any more information below. Yeah, to get more information on Maria. Thank you so much, Maria. This was an absolutely fantastic, inspiring interview. I thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for tuning in to Off the Clock. Don't miss next week's tips around innovation and HR. Subscribe to the show. You can catch us on YouTube, Apple, iHeart, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. Until next time, be kind and thrive.